This is Laura Stevenson and her bandmates Alex Billig and Peter Nadeo playing a song called The Healthy One off Laura's second album, Sit Resist.
The whole thing is supposed to be like, it's kind of like a children's song. And then when Alex had the accordion, it just made sense and it sounded so perfect. It was really cool. It was like the perfect tool that we had for that song.
Sit Resist has been remastered and will be reissued by Don Giovanni Records on September 4th, 2020. Life's Work is a podcast about Sit Resist. The story of a songwriter hitting her stride and the community who helped her songs grow even bigger. I'm Tim Crisp for Better Yet, and this is Life's Work. Laura Stevenson had already found a community for her music touring with Bomb the Music Industry, first as a member, and then with her own band. That band would be billed as Laura Stevenson and the Cans, a name that sort of fit with the patterns of the messy little organization.
Well, the name kind of came up early on from like people from Long Island that were playing with me. And then it was just like, it's so stupid sounding. Like, it's just kind of like too like fun, but I kept it because I was like, what am I kidding? Like, I'm going to come up with like a serious band name right now. So like when like we started getting more serious and like playing actual shows, I was just like, eh, fuck it. And then it just kind of like stayed. And I can't even think about the personnel. Like, I'm trying to think about the amount of people that have played, because honestly, when there's really nobody steering the ship, like I'm supposed to be, but as a captain, I would say I'm not awesome, because I'm just like, come on, like, who cares? There's no rules. Because like, that was what I learned from Jeff.
Yeah, I think me and Laura both are, and especially at that time, but I think in general, we're both people. It's like, hey, you want to play in my band? That sounds fun. More people in our band. Let's do this.
But it started to become a little bit more streamlined, which was probably for the best.
Chris Parker started playing drums more regularly with the band. Chris was a childhood friend of Alex Billig, who brought a seemingly endless well of friends into the fold and also helped bring Laura and Mike into Brooklyn's booming DIY scene.
He, at the time, was doing these annual DIY festivals called Hillstock that started as small as just in his backyard. He had like the rare luxury of Brooklyn where you actually have like a 20 by 20 foot yard. That was definitely not the case for most of us. But he, you know, over a few years, built it into a thing where, you know, they got permits from the city and had a stage set up in a blocked off block party environment. You know, it was just this 3 or 4 years where everyone was sort of working and contributing to this DIY scene being actually, you know, possible to sustain and maintain. So him being involved with that and having, you know, regular communication with all these bands that were maybe not descended directly from punk, you know, he had 50 bands a year playing this festival. So he would, because he was in regular contact with them, he would sort of be bringing show opportunities or, you know, just things that were out of the realm of what Laura or I would have naturally been drawn to based on where we came from. You know, so we sort of branched out to be playing other places, like those early Silent Barn Death by Audio shows. It's definitely less of Long Island punk pedigree, you know, it's more like people from everywhere that moved to New York in order to be involved in a scene like that.
A focal point to Brooklyn DIY in the late 2000s was Death by Audio, a warehouse space in Williamsburg which serves as a home base for bands like A Place to Bury Strangers and Dan Deacon, right alongside New York and New Jersey punk bands like Screaming Females and Shell Shag.
It was a really good convergence of scenes, because then I think shortly after that, Jeff and Bomb became very heavily involved and ingratiated in that whole Death by Audio scene. So I think all of that coming together, and it was very much at the time, you know, even more so than Long Island ever was, more diverse aesthetically, as far as you don't have to sound a specific way in order for people to like your band. It's more like we're all doing this with the same, you know, ethos or spirit, where you could have a hardcore band play right before Laura band plays at Death by Audio, you know?
Something special was happening in Brooklyn, but something special was happening all across the country, too. Not just in major cities like New York and Philadelphia, but places like Cleveland, Bloomington, Indiana, Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. The internet was making it easier for bands to connect with each other and route their own tours. And it's not like bands were only seeking to connect with bands who sounded exactly like them. They were just finding the people who had the desire to do it and to do it for others. From these connections come communities. It doesn't have to be one person. It doesn't have to be one band. This is something that Jeff Rosenstock has lived by since he was back in Long Island.
If we all just kind of bring each other up, the pressure isn't really put on anybody to try and, like, be famous. I think we could all just kind of, like, hang out in this, like, lower middle area of success where, like, it's good enough that we can, like, play house shows in small towns and play small venues in big cities kind of thing, you know? Which is, I think, where it ended up with a lot of our bands, you know?
This was also put into practice by Mike's roommate, Dave Garwacki.
Well, Dave came up in the same scenes that we came up in, you know? He's from Jersey as well. And he just, like, he played in bands, he toured, he knew all these people that were in this, like, small DIY touring scene throughout the country. And they would always come through Brooklyn to play, and they'd always be staying with Mike and Dave. So their floor was just always littered with bodies. And then they'd play, they'd do a pink couch session in the morning, you know, and everybody would be hungover. And it was great because it was just like, it's all part of the same scene. So it's like a record label where, like, you have the roster of bands that are, you know, but it's like, it's just performances, you know, and you can download the songs and then you find out about other bands that are associated with one another in one way or another. I mean, and Dave just wanted to share that with the world because he loved everybody that walked through his door, you know.
The Pink Couch Sessions brought together folks ranging from AJJ to Nana Grizzal, Waxahachie, Tiger's Jaw. Seriously, YouTube, search Pink Couch Sessions. Have yourself a fun couple of hours. But the first of those sessions featured Laura, Mike, and Alex performing Amphibian off of a record. The band was stretching into new and different corners of DIY, but when they were offered their first slot on a non-DIY tour, like a professional one, opening for Maps and Atlases and Cults, the final piece of the Sit Resist lineup would fall into place.
And that was sort of how Peter joined the band. Because when we were getting ready to do that tour, we asked Jeff if he could do it playing guitar, because that's who had been playing with us previously. Jeff wasn't able to because he was doing a bomb tour. We asked Matt Keegan if he would play guitar. He wasn't able to because he was going to be on bomb tour. And so it was like, we have this tour opportunity that we really shouldn't say no to. Who's going to play guitar? And Alex, again, he knew Peter and played in other bands with Peter and said Peter would be great.
And so I must have met Peter, but I didn't really get to know Peter very well until he started playing with us, or like right around that time, because I was going and watching his project, Archipelago, and like listening to his music, which is really awesome. He's such a good songwriter.
Peter came in seamlessly, learned all the songs on his own. We did not have a full band practice before that tour. So the first time all five of us played together was at this Ann Arbor, Michigan show with Maps and Atlases.
How'd it go?
Great show. Yeah. We started and ended every song.
Having us be so close to each other, you know, like me, Mike, Peter, Alex, and then Chris Parker, who played drums on the record, and he lived pretty close by. He lived in like Williamsburg, Bushwick, and we were all in Clinton Hill.
We played a bunch in Brooklyn, and we did a very thankless, arduous tour of the entire U.S., and it was really bad. You know, just long drives. But at the time, we were just like 23, 24, 25, being like, yeah, we like playing music, so let's go play music everywhere. With, you know, no safety net at all. It was just like, we're just going to go out and do it. Which was sort of the place that Laura and I both came from prior. You know, like my experience in Latterman, her experience in Bomb. That was just how you toured then, you know. But at the end of that tour, we met Joe Steinhardt from Don Giovanni in Syracuse.
The first time I saw Laura Stevenson perform was in Syracuse in April of 2010.
Joe Steinhardt started Don Giovanni Records when he was in college at Boston University, which is how he knew Alex and Pete.
I had listened to a record a couple times, you know, that week, just because I knew I was going to see Laura and Alex was in the band.
What about the performance, like, stood out to you?
She's a great songwriter. I've always been a huge fan of songwriting. Like, a lot of what I listen to that's not through, you know, the label or through punk is songwriting based.
As it turned out, the show in Syracuse wasn't even a full band show. It was just Mike and Laura. But being a friend of Alex, Joe offered them a place to stay that night.
Yeah, we went to his apartment and he was very strange. And he put on a Blink-182 home movie thing that Mike really liked. And I was like, this is bad, but I love it. And I love that he owns this. And he also had like a pantry full of Easy Mac. And that was like the only food he had. Just like those like little single servings of macaroni and cheese. Oh, and we watched The Room, the Tommy Wiseau movie. So it was like watching that Blink-182 thing and watching The Room and eating Easy Mac and just like chilling with this weirdo. And I just like fell in love with him. I was like, this is my friend. And we've been friends ever since.
Don Giovanni Records was started by Joe and his friend Zach Gajewski simply as a means for Zach and Joe to put out their thrash band 7-Inch. But the focus shifted when the two moved back to New Brunswick, New Jersey. The college town had produced legendary pop-punk bands like Lifetime and the Bouncing Souls in the 90s, and it was about to hit its second renaissance. And Don Giovanni was there to document it.
All of a sudden, there was like this band, The Ergs, and then they introduced me to this other band, The Steinways. And then by that point, this band For Science that Zach and I were in with my friend John. So there was like For Science and Steinways and Ergs, Unlovables. There was like this small but tight-knit like New York, New Jersey pop-punk scene.
The Ergs were like a thunderbolt to the punk scene. Classic Ramones-style punk, songs about falling in love and bubblegum, but with an air of adventure as they piled on influences from the Beatles to John Coltrane. But much like their songs, they were over before anyone was ready. And unfortunately, that wave of bands soon followed suit.
All these bands broke up like the same time. It's around 2007, 2008. By 2008, none of those bands existed. And there was this question of like, is the label just over? But it wasn't, because music in New Brunswick was still going great. And there was this band, it's called Screaming Females, that were starting. And they really wanted to work with Don Giovanni because we were the label that was putting out The Ergs. And then Screaming Females became very successful, obviously. By now, but even then they became relatively successful. So by the time I met Laura, like the label had come a long way since college when I first met Alex and Pete. And so in 2010, we had like The Measure, we had, you know, Screaming Females, and we were kind of working with a lot of the local bands in Brooklyn and in New Jersey in the scene that Laura was playing in at the time.
When we met Joe, Laura gave Joe a copy of a record and was like, I have a whole new album written and it's really good. Like Laura said that to Joe. And Joe was like, really good, huh? And then like, you see the Kirster? It's like, I mean, just like, oh, okay. And then like Joe for a while would like, you know, check in with Laura, call her just to be like, hey, how's it going? Oh, I want to set you guys up a show in New Brunswick.
He had been talking about wanting to have this conversation, you know, leading up to it. And so I was ready to have the conversation. The band was ready to have the conversation because we had a lot of fucking long drives and like no radio. So like we had a lot of conversations to have in the van about this conversation we were going to have with Joe. Then we finally get to the show and Joe is fucking wasted. This is a house show. And a band that he really liked was going to be put. Yes, the Grass Trusted.
He was like, I really love your band. I really want to put out this record. And then Grab Ass Charleston's were starting to play. And he was like, I'm sorry. I don't want this to take away from how serious I am about this, but I really got to go watch them. They're my favorite band.
They were one of my favorite bands at the time also. They never came up to the East Coast. They were from Gainesville. So I saw them only a small handful of times.
And so we're like, okay, I guess Joe's serious, but maybe not 100% serious. He's like, you guys are my favorite band, but they're like my favorite band. I remember vividly he said that.
But we had been like anticipating this conversation for like weeks. And then he was just like really way too drunk to have the conversation. And then Chris, our drummer, who was like the most like professional of all of us, you know, like he had like a real job and he was just like very mature. And like me and Alex and Peter and Mike were just like, whatever, like we're cool to sleep on the floor of the van. Like, this is fun. And Chris was like, this is, we gotta like, you know, like he was like a real person kind of. Not saying that like the four of us weren't real people, but we were just like, I think we're just like a little punker in our, just like our need for creature comforts. Yes, we were scummier. We were scummier. And Chris was like, you know, he had like a nice apartment and like a job and he like wore clean clothes and like got haircuts. So at the end of the conversation, Chris was like, you're going to put a record out with this guy? Like this was like his pitch. And he like couldn't even like talk to you about it. Like he was like too drunk to give you the pitch. And I was just like, yeah, but he seems pretty cool. And then we did it. And then I've been putting out records with him ever since.
Talks of professionalism aside, it was things like Brooklyn DIY, quote unquote, and If You Make It, that made the relationship between Don Giovanni and Laura Stevenson come together so naturally.
But there was websites like If You Make It that just had video clips of bands playing and interviews. It was basically a fanzine, but it was a little different because you could also like kind of, you could host your demo on there. It was like a mix of like file sharing and fanzine. And a bunch of our artists were in that community, like in one way or another, like either they had their demo there or they did a pink couch session or something. And so there were all these things springing up at the time that were sort of on their own terms building punk communities, and I found them pretty inspiring.
Laura brought a connection between her world of Long Island ska and punk, If You Make It, over to Don Giovanni's roster, which is rooted in the New Brunswick scene. The fact that Laura's music wasn't actually quote-unquote punk speaks to an evolution of a term that applied now more to an ethos than it did to a sound.
I think people started to really explore that kind of thing. And what could you do through the punk lens? A record like Sit Resist, an artist like Laura, I think resonated really well with that crowd, myself included.
Laura helped bring Don Giovanni into its next evolution. But it's one that they've never left. Sit Resist ushered in the era of folks like Waxahachie, Mitski, Mal Bloom, songwriters with less punk aesthetic, putting out records with Don Giovanni.
I still look to it as like one of the like foundational records of the label, in the sense that that's like, for a lot of people, when they think of the record label, they think of Sit Resist and they think of Laura Stevenson, they think of Waxahachie, they think of Screaming Females. I think in a lot of ways, like I also think of it that way myself, like this record especially, where it felt like I was doing something a little bigger with the label.
It was a step in like a slightly more professional direction, maybe, but on this absolutely same level, you know, like that we were, you know, like Joe just had access to like things that I didn't think about before, you know, like a publicist or like whatever, you know, like, but like it was all, the roster was all just the same types of people, you know, that I probably would have met eventually, you know, because they're friends with, you know, all the same bands. They're playing Death by Audio and like all these little, you know, Silent Barn, all these little places, just on different nights, you know.
Punk and DIY were growing and evolving, and so was the circle around Laura and her songs. The next step was the studio to make her second record, a record with a very intentional name.
I just was like not stopping moving. We were just like constantly going and going and not stopping. And I think that if I did stop, then everything would kind of fall apart. So I think that that's basically what it's about. It's just like momentum. It hurts to be the healthy one. Oh, 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 oh.
Life's Work is a production of Don Giovanni Records and Better Yet. To pre-order the remastered Sit Resist, visit dongiovannirecords.com. For more info on Better Yet visit betteryetpod.com. Next week on Life's Work.
There are very few distractions except for the military base that on Fridays decides to open up the weapons range. And so on tons of recordings done in that studio, you'll hear like odd, like automatic weapon sounds in the background and the occasional bomb blast. So I would assume if you listen carefully or closely to that record, you'll definitely hear like a bomb blast here or there.